Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a new history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week I'm very pleased to say we have Joyce Salisbury on the show, and we'll be talking about her book, The Beast Within, Animals in the Middle Ages. I have three cats, and I love them all. I feed them. I take care of them. I take them to the doctor. I let them sit on my chest. I clean up their leavings, let's put it that way. They live in my house. They've, in fact, never really been outside. One of the things that I learned in reading Joyce Salisbury's The Beast Within is that this is a very unusual thing, that 500 or 600 or 1,000 years ago, animals were treated in a very different way than the way I treat my three cats. They were property. They did not have souls and were not, therefore, treated like humans. There were all kinds of restrictions about which ones you could eat and which ones you couldn't. We don't even really know if they were named, but they prompted a lot of very interesting questions among people who thought about matters theological. They thought about what you could eat and what you couldn't eat. And remember, Christians here, not Jews so much in the Middle Ages, were sort of at sea because the New Testament doesn't say a lot about what you should eat. They thought about how animals should or should not be treated. Again, there's this thorny question of whether animals might have souls. And then there's the pretty obvious similarity between humans, that is, human bodies, and the bodies of animals. And this caused people of the Middle Ages to wonder as well about what animals were and how they should be treated and what sort of relationship they had with humanity at large. And of course, it caused them to ponder what a human was. Joyce does a really terrific job of talking about all of these things, and it's a fascinating journey through the history of mentalities about animals. I really enjoyed talking to her today, and I think that you'll enjoy the interview. So without further delay, here it is. Hi, Joyce.
Hi, Marshall.
How are you today?
Good.
I'm glad to hear it. I should tell our listeners that we have Joyce Salisbury on the show today, and we'll be talking about her book, which is both new and, I don't want to say old, but it is renewed, let's put it that way, called The Beast Within, Animals in the Middle Ages. This is really a terrific book for anybody who's interested in medieval history and anybody who's interested in what a human is and what an animal is, because as Joyce points out in the book, that is really what people in the Middle Ages were thinking about when they were thinking about animals. And I would argue that it's also what we think about when we think about animals, is what is a human and what is an animal and where do we draw the line? And Joyce has a lot of interesting things to say about it herself. And the people of the Middle Ages who she interrogates through these ancient and, I can tell you, difficult to read sources, they have a lot to say as well. And she does a terrific job of elucidating their thoughts and also, I think, saying a little bit about how we came to think of animals in the way that we think of them. So this is really our first venture into animal history here on New Books in History, and I was really happy to have Joyce as a companion in it. I think that you'll enjoy the interview. Joyce, let me begin our talk by asking you to say a few words about yourself.
Well, I grew up in South America, in Brazil and Mexico, and didn't move to the States until I was a teenager.
Really?
And it gave me,
You told me you weren't. You told me you weren't going to drop something like that. In the pre-interview, Joyce said, "Oh no, okay, go ahead."
Okay, and so I went to graduate school at Rutgers University, and it was a good fit for me because Rutgers specializes in social history, and in particular, something called the Knoll School of History, which I was fortunate to study. In that school. And what that school does is it says, you know, if you take a really broad view of history, you can learn, get lots of new insights. And so I was fortunate enough to be encouraged to speculate on such broad things like, what did people think about sex and what did people think about animals? So that led me to this work, which allows me to take a very broad view without worrying about whether someone's going to say, yeah, but what did someone in 982 Spain think? And I say, oh, whatever, I'm using a broad brush here.
And the people at Rutgers, who did you work with at Rutgers?
Trajan Stojanovic, who was a fabulous, he's deceased now, he's a fabulous Knoll School historian, one of the greats who studied directly under Ferdinand Braudel, if anyone knows. And so actually when I got my job here at the University of Wisconsin in Green Bay, they were thrilled that I was the sort of third generation from Braudel.
Yeah. Maybe you could just say a few words about the origins and the essence of the Knoll School. I think some of our – anybody who's gone to graduate school in history knows what this is. But I think that many people that read books, especially broad brush thematic books such as yours, and I've written one myself, and who is indebted to this school, but they may not know about it. So maybe you could just give us a very short paragraph or two about what the Annales School, where it came from and what it is.
Well, it came from France, where people and scholars, Braudel was the first probably, but there were many others who say, you know, one of the things that you can look at in social history, what's important isn't an event. It's these giant movements of time in three parts. Broad time that hardly moves at all, like a mountain that stands there forever, continues to influence the environment surrounding it. And then there's medium kind of time, which shepherds who walk their sheep up and down the mountain have a certain flow of time. And then in the tip top, there are events. You know, oh, someone dropped a bomb on the shepherd. You know, that would be an event.
Mm-hmm.
But to understand the event, the Annales School would suggest you have to know about the timeless shepherd and the even more timeless mountain.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to take a broad view of history in order to understand the headlines.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is that good?
Yeah, no, that's excellent. And it's funny, this is something that I was taught myself. I wrote an article recently called The Internet Changes Nothing. It was posted online, and I got a lot of flack for it. But it really takes that perspective. And what I meant by the article was that you really have to put something like a new medium, in this case, in a much broader framework to understand exactly where it came from and what it is. So, I mean, I think that almost all historians work in this threefold framework now, whether they know it or not. And many of the books that you read, I think, are cast in it as well. So I don't. And I think,
another aspect of it, if I may interrupt you for a second,
yeah,
is that the question that I have explored repeatedly is mentalité,
mm-hmm,
you know, mindsets.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it remains a bit of a controversial piece of history because if I study what did people think about sex, inevitably someone will say, oh, wait, I have 10 people who thought something different, you know. What do you mean by people? What people? And again, the Annales School, and I would agree that you can make these kind of sweeping sort of generalizations, leaving aside all the exceptions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. So this mentalité is what interests me,
mm-hmm,
in terms of what do people think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think Americans especially need to hear about this because all Americans think that all of their thoughts are original.
I know.
Yeah.
And the immediate thought is something, it's like, oh, I mean, this happened, you know, this thought's old, it's 5 years old. Oh,
yeah.
Wait.
Yeah, right. No, I think I had an original idea about once. I can't even tell you what it is, but I'm not going to. So in any event, let's talk a little bit about the book. How did you come to write this book? It first came out in, was it 1994, is that right?
94, yeah.
94, before the second edition that has additional material. How did you come to write it? What was your thought process in formulating the research problem?
Well, whenever I write something or research something, it grows out of some strange question I have, something that looks utterly peculiar to me. And my mentor, Stoyanovich, always said, if there's something in the past that seems incomprehensible, that's actually the key to the past. That,
mm-hmm,
will unlock the mentalité of the past.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, okay. And I had run across some primary sources, oddly sort of bestiality sources, in which a law might say, oh, bestiality in this time period is nothing. There's no penalty. And in this other time period, it's capital crime. And I'm thinking, well, that's pretty peculiar. Well, that tells me that some kind of mindset change is going on here. And so there were a couple of animal references like that. And I thought, well, maybe I'll look into that. But then when I started to look into it, it occurred to me that I had opened a can of worms because it meant I had to understand what people thought of animals. And then, oh, rats, what they thought of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So there you have it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Had anything been written on this prior to your book?
Not so broadly. Do you know? I mean, people might have looked at laws that included laws about animals. Or they might have looked at literature, fable literature, and kept it in terms of that source. So what I did was to use all the sources on animals, whether they're literary or historical or legal or chronicles, everything that I could read that looked at an animal, and then said, okay, then all of those things must inform what people thought about animals. So no one had tried to take this broad view. Mm-hmm. Oh, and by the way, I also wanted to take a view of art. I love art. And I thought, okay, if I could see what people looked at and how they portrayed animals, that might tell me something too. And so I actually needed to look for some place that had, you know, a zillion illustrations of medieval manuscripts so I could literally count them. And I went to St. John's Abbey in Minneapolis and stayed there a week counting pictures in the manuscripts. And it was very informative. I mean, to say, oh, wow, you know, the only pictures they put in the center are pictures of oxen.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the only animal that informed. But after the 12th century, weird hybrid animals started proliferating. Mm-hmm. So in every place I looked, whether it was literary sources or laws, I mentioned the bestiality laws, or images, there was a change in how people expressed their view of animals. Mm-hmm. So there
mm-hmm.
I was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one thing I wanted to talk about when pursuing a thematic topic like this, I think people today, more than ever before, are sort of losing touch with what it is to collect this kind of material. And that's precisely because of the search engine. You know, people think you can type the words animals in Middle Ages in Google and get every source. That's not quite right. How do you collect the sources for something like this, and where are they?
Well, as a medievalist, there's a particular advantage and a disadvantage. Medievalists, the disadvantage is there are a limited amount of sources left. You know, if you're going to study 20th century America, you'll be buried. You can't mm-hmm. read everything that was written in 20th century America, you know, even if you're good. But in the Middle Ages, you can probably read pretty much what was there. So, you know, so it means, but on the downside, you only have a limited amount of information. So mm-hmm. you have to tease out as much as you can from every little source.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so if it says, oh, I killed a pig, then I quickly write down, oh, pig, one dead pig, you know. Yay, I have, you know, I have a pig. You know, so it's just approaching everything. So mm-hmm. what I did was say, okay, I'm going to read all the laws I can and jot down every one that has to do with animals. I'm going to blast through all the literary sources and every one that has to do with animals. And I like that approach. Again, it's kind of an anal approach because I go into it without necessarily any preconceived idea.
Uh-huh.
I'm just going to spread like note cards all over.
Uh-huh.
Pigs decline after this year.
Yeah, no, I see what you mean. So
it's fun. I mean, I like it.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, today if you wanted to know what people think about animals, I don't know, you would probably read a book called What People Think About Animals. But
better, you'd read my book.
Yeah, right. So let's hope. What were the genres in which these, you mentioned law codes is one of them. What are the genres in which we find information about animals in medieval sources?
Also, chronicles. People mm-hmm. describe, oh, I went for a ride on my dappled horse today, you know, mm-hmm. so that. Fables were huge, curiously, and it's a genre that historians haven't done much with because, well, you know what a fable is, you mm-hmm. know, the fox escaped with the cheese, stole it from the raven.
Mm-hmm.
The moral of the story is, either foxes are smarter than ravens, or don't be stupid if a fox comes near you, you know, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But to explore those literary sources were very important to me to see how people expressed what they believed about animals. Also, what in the Middle Ages would be considered the scientific sources. I mean, you've got a couple of those. You've got bestiaries, which are supposed to be like an encyclopedia of animals, everything you want to know about animals. For example, in the Middle Ages, in the bestiary, you'd learn that elephants don't have knees, so they have to lean against the tree to nap.
Mm-hmm.
You'd learn all those important things. In addition, the theologians, they were huge. You know, when you get someone like Albert the Great saying, oh, well, the semen of a bear is different from the semen of a human.
Mm-hmm.
So gleaning all of those little details about what all of those genres said about animals, it's really a lot.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I want to kind of set the scene before we start to talk about the chapters particularly. And you know, I think one of the things that needs to be said is that most of these people, Most of the, well, look, medieval people were largely illiterate, let's say that. And also they lived cheek by jowl with animals. Is that right? Yes. They lived with
that's
animals.
Absolutely right.
Yeah, to a degree that we can hardly imagine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's right.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so they knew a lot about animals.
They did. And what's also curious is they both knew a lot about animals, and yet the animals of the imagination or of the science was totally inaccurate.
Yeah.
So in some ways, there's two kinds of animals, and probably today as well. I mean, those that you take for granted,
mm-hmm.
and those that you somehow imagine that become metaphors for who you are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you do a nice job of talking about that near the last chapters of the book. Well, let's just launch into it then. The first chapter of the book is called Animals as Property. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, first let me say that to start that out is that, in fact, in the Middle Ages, they conceived as of real animals only as the degree to which it's useful for humans.
Mm-hmm.
So they would never say, oh, don't kill a wolf. The wolf has a right to live.
Mm-hmm.
The animal as property is the primary relationship. And if there's an animal that you don't own, it's, you know, you can kill it, you can do whatever. That, mm-hmm. you know, so the first linking of humans and animals is the property. And what this chapter does is it looks like very much sort of the laws and the medieval tracts to tell you how did they use animals. So property animals are those animals who work for you, those animals that you use for, I call it parts and labor.
Mm-hmm.
The parts, I mean, we're so used to being able to wear nylon or cotton. Remember, they were wearing wool or leather, that every part of the animal essentially became part of you.
Mm-hmm.
And in treating animals as property, as the idea of the animal, is that the animal is different from us. That mm-hmm. was their goal. I should say that. Once you treat animals as property, that means it can be your tractor.
Mm-hmm.
It can be your chair. Mm-hmm. That it's not you. You are not an animal. You are not property. So by the property division of treating humans as animals, I mean treating animals as not human, that set the tone of what they believed was the appropriate relationship between humans and animals.
Mm-hmm.
That we are not property, they are not us.
Mm-hmm. I actually wanted to ask, in fact, interject just for a second. I know this from another connection, but there were people, I don't know if the specific people that wrote about animals knew about this, were involved in it, but there were people who were property at the time. That is, they were slaves. Is there any relationship between this discourse about animals as property and people as property? Was there any tension there that you found in any of the sources?
You know what's I thought of that, and what was interesting to me is in the early Middle Ages, well, I should set out the thesis of this book first so you'll understand.
Please.
I mean, in the early Middle Ages, the church said humans are humans, animals are animals, that we're dramatically different. You know, there's a chasm of difference between us, that humans named animals, they own animals, they control animals, humans are privileged. So then that would raise the question, well, what about slaves? In the beginning of the Middle Ages, there were fewer. Serfs sort of took over. But they were privileged as being not animal, so they were better off.
Uh-huh.
In the 12th century, I argue, that the lines began to blur for various reasons. By the 12th century, people thought, oh, well, maybe we are sort of animal-like. Then you have the opportunity to say, oh, well, that means that some people are more animal-like than others,
uh-huh.
then when you own a slave, then that's an animal.
I see.
Because the lines have blurred.
Mm-hmm.
And so then the way the idea of human and animal, you're crueler to some humans.
Yep. Yeah, no, I see what you
mean. Because the lines blur. But in the early Middle Ages, no problem. If you were, even if you were a slave and property, you were still so dramatically different from an animal that you had a leg up.
Right. So let's follow this tangent. Just it's not exactly a tangent, but I kind of want to ask this question. What was the theological foundation of the difference between animals and humans? I mean, they're both creatures of God. Was it the fact that humans had a soul, or what was it exactly? Where do they find the sort of... Yeah.
Humans have a soul. And if humans have a soul and animals don't have a soul, there you have the chasm of difference. I mean, that was as simple and as complicated as a solution. So if animals don't have souls, you know, that immediately moves you out. By the way, that meant in the Middle Ages there are no dogs in heaven, no animals in heaven.
Right, no doggy because, cemeteries. Right.
Yeah, exactly. No. You know, and so if I can follow this tangent a bit more, now there are theologians who argue that there will be animals in heaven.
Yeah.
And so then they have to do some theological juggling to argue that, and the basic theological argument, or the most prevalent one for animals in heaven, is that not the animals have souls, but that God created this sort of web of creation.
Uh-huh.
So as humans get swept up into heaven, the web goes with.
Right, exactly.
But if animals can't go to heaven and don't have souls, then people like Aquinas say, you know, you can't even be friends with an animal,
mm-hmm.
which eliminates pets. There's no emotional rapport with an animal because they don't have a soul.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's how animals are different. And that's why you can be as cruel as you want to your farm animal.
Right, right. Because we were given, I mean, one of the theological foundations is we're given dominion over animals, correct? Is that right, scripturally?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's right. And they knew this. So they're like, well, we're given dominion over these things, and they are things because they don't have souls.
Yes. And in fact, the most prevalent portrayal in art of animals in the early Middle Ages was the moment, the biblical moment, when Adam names the animal.
Mm-hmm.
And by naming them, you're a giraffe, you're a lion, that means he owns who they are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I see. Yeah, no, that's... Yeah, that's very interesting. And you mentioned pets. Did people have pets in the early Middle Ages?
You know, one of the reasons I wrote this second edition is because every time I did a talk in the first edition, I mean, people said, oh, your book is great, but what about the pets?
Yeah,
what about the pets?
Right.
And I said, no, there are no pets. Stop with the pets. Stop with the pets already. And because, in a sense, what is a pet? I mean, first we'd have to get that definition. And in the second edition here, I have added, fine, I'll give you a chapter on pets, right, that I call animals as humans, because a pet is an animal that doesn't have to work for a living.
Right.
He doesn't have, he has nothing to do with serving you.
Uh-huh.
A pet is just there for affection, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
But an animal, a pet animal, beginning in the 12th century, is an animal that you feed. So
yeah.
It gets its food for nothing. It doesn't have to work for a living.
Yeah.
And in fact, as extreme as that goes, I hope we're not being too tangential, but in the 16th century, when there were property laws written in England, they said, well, you know, it's not a felony or a crime to steal a pet because pets are useless.
Yeah.
So you can't arrest someone for
really?
Stealing a useless animal.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
So
you know,
now, then the question was, did people in the early Middle Ages love their animals like a pet? I don't know. I have to think so.
Uh-huh.
You know, I don't
yeah.
know. I can hardly believe you would have a dog on your hearth that you didn't feel some affection for,
mm-hmm.
or a great horse, you know. And so they probably felt affection, but I separate that from the notion of pet.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we have this expression, and I don't know where it's from, to treat someone like a dog, which is archaic because we treat dogs really well.
Oh, and I do have an argument for where that saying comes
from.
Okay,
go ahead.
You know, okay. So starting in the 12th century, as the lines blur between humans and animals, then you start getting a little freaked about whether you're going to be like an animal.
Yeah.
So what we do then with our rhetorical style is if we use as an insult those animals who are closest to us, dog,
yeah.
pig,
uh-huh.
monkey. And we use as a compliment those animals that are really animals of a metaphor.
Uh-huh.
Lion, he's a bear. You see?
Yeah.
So by using those close animals close to us as a rhetorical style, as the separation, as an insult,
uh-huh.
then we're able to preserve a distance.
Right, right, right. No, I see what you mean. You know, that's an interesting point. So let's actually now these animals were not only things in the law. And in people's minds, that is, things of utility, things we used and could treat as property, there were also things that we put inside ourselves. There are things we ate. And this also raises some peculiar questions as well. I'm going to come to that in just a second. But why don't you describe the relationship between humans and animals as food?
Yes. So, all right. So animals as food, of course, that is seems a primary relationship. We do eat animals. But I was sort of surprised at how many rules go around that. For example, we don't eat dogs in the West. We in the West don't eat dogs. We don't eat carnivores in the West because that seems animal on animal, you know? So it seems less bestial to eat herbivores. So in the West, with the exception of pigs, omnivores, we eat herbivores.
Mm-hmm.
It's also a sense of avoiding a taboo of cannibalism, because if you eat an animal that ate meat, you're eating the meat it ate.
Yeah.
So they have laws, for example, on you can't eat a pig or a chicken who has eaten a human. Hmm. And I got to tell you, I got stalled on that. Are there attack chickens around?
Yeah.
Does this happen a lot, that you have to pass a law against eating a chicken that's eaten a human? But I guess it's if the chicken got near a body, a dead body, it would eat, it would snack. So, you know, so then the question is, can you use such animals? And you have to let them starve themselves. You have to starve them down to bones and then feed them up on appropriate food.
Uh-huh.
And then you can eat them. So the question of what we, you know, it's a saying, you are what you eat.
Yeah.
And this preoccupied people in the Middle Ages a lot. Mm-hmm. I think it probably preoccupies us as well, by the way.
Yeah.
So they were very careful to try to think about what they eat. And, you know, all of these preoccupations in each of these first two chapters, animals as property and animals as food, it's kind of they had an ideal in their mind. Humans are humans, animals as property. Humans eat animals, animals don't eat humans. We keep our lines separate. But built into both those relationships is an ambiguity. If you own something, it owns you. That's how I feel every time I have to take my car in to be fixed. I'm not sure who's owning who here. But
I think there's something Buddhist about that, that, you know.
Yeah, sure. You know, so every bit of property, then you, it owns you as well, you know, so that the lines blur as much as you wish they wouldn't. And it's even more true with food, mm-hmm. because after all, if you are what you eat, Thomas Aquinas worried about people eating pork chops, and then the meat turns into their own flesh, mm-hmm. and then when the human flesh gets resurrected on the day of judgment, did that pork chop you ate get resurrected? Do you know? Was it the human flesh that's being resurrected, or the animal flesh that fed it?
Mm-hmm.
So, mm-hmm. you know, the lines blur in those moments, in the great open mouth of the appetite, and
mm-hmm.
teeth crunching down on animal flesh, we suddenly become one with the animal.
I was just going to observe that Christians, serious Christians like these, are kind of in a spot because the New Testament doesn't really say anything about what we should eat. Well, I'm going to return to that in a second. It says we should eat one thing, and that's a peculiar thing. But the Old Testament says lots of things about what you should and shouldn't eat. You can just go to Leviticus, and it's all sort of mapped out there for you. For those listeners who are or know Orthodox Jews, I mean, they have a nice set of instructions. There's almost no ambiguity at all. It's true that they might debate a little bit, you know, what is kosher and what is not, but it's pretty darn clear about what you can and can't eat. Did these Christian theologians ever have reference to those Old Testamentary laws?
Well, the Old Testament, let's see, the references to what you should eat and not eat, in part they're for cleanliness, but more often they're to define Jews as not everybody else.
Yeah.
So by eating separately, you have maintained your community in a separate way.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Christians then said, you know, all that's out of the window because
right.
we aren't maintaining ourselves separate. We don't have to do that anymore. So then they dreamed up more different rules.
Mm-hmm.
And so the prohibition, the Christian prohibition, I mean, they had to let pigs in, I guess, because people really liked their pork. So they loved that. And that's, as I said, that's the one omnivore that sneaks in.
Mm-hmm.
So the Christian prohibitions had more to do with meat on meat.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which, by the way, mad cow disease is probably a good idea.
Yeah, no, not a bad idea. Not a bad idea at all. Yeah. No, it's true. But Christians are kind of at sea when it comes to dietary laws. I don't.
It is.
Yeah,
everything's wide open. You can eat whatever you want.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing: you have to eat, and that is you're supposed to eat the body and drink the blood of Jesus Christ. What did people think about that? How does that fit into the dietary laws and eating animals and things like that? Did people discuss this? Did it occur to them that there was something odd about this?
They discussed everything. All right, so here's the thing. You are what you eat, right? I mean, we've established that as a baseline.
Uh-huh.
And so then, if you eat the flesh of God, what does that mean?
That's a good thing. Good. Yeah, it's good. Yeah.
Right, it's good. So then you become godlike. So then your body, which has become like God's body, will be resurrected.
Mm-hmm.
So, and one of the interesting food metaphors and animal metaphors that I ran through in this chapter on animals as food is hell itself was a mouth that would eat your unsaved flesh.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
Both the images of hell in the art and in the descriptions are of a mouth that crunches you up.
Oh, yeah.
So then hell or the worms in the ground eat you.
Yeah.
Your body has become meat instead
right.
of what it was supposed to be, which was not meat.
Yeah.
So the saved body, saved because you ate the blood of Christ, you've become like Christ, your body is indigestible.
Uh-huh. That's very interesting. I hadn't thought of that because it sheds a certain amount of light on all these metaphors that I learned, again, growing up in the Midwest, not in a particularly religious background, but, you know, hell is a mouth. And you also, interestingly enough, before you're eaten, you get roasted.
Yeah, exactly. Bad enough, you're going to become meat. You're going to be roast meat.
Yeah, that's right. You get roasted on a spit, and then you get eaten. Yeah, so that's really very interesting. I had not thought of that at all. But, yeah, thank you for enlightening me about that particular metaphor.
A nice image to play
yeah,
in your head.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, it's So anyway, let's move on to another thing that you talk about, which is, a little bit disturbing, but we're all adults here. And this is animals and sexuality. Some of it has to do with animals themselves having sex with one another, but some of it also has to do with people having sex with animals. What exactly did medieval people think about this, both in the early and then the later period?
Well, this to me was the piece that led me to notice such a dramatic change. Now, some of the laws that I was looking at are penitential. That means when you go and confess to the priest, I did this, you get, here's your penance. So then by comparing the penances, you can see what people thought of the various sins, okay? So in the early Middle Ages, having sex with an animal was the same ranking as masturbation. And I thought, okay, that's pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Not like we have.
Mm-mm.
And so what that meant was if they weren't afraid of losing their humanity in sexual intercourse with an animal, and the animal was just a thing. It was a nothing.
Mm-hmm.
But then after the 12th century, when people get more afraid of losing their humanity into the animality and animal world, well, then having sex with an animal turned into a capital crime by the 13th century. And so, and incidentally, modern times, in Wisconsin in the 1960s, a man was sent to jail for being caught having sex with animals, even though the Kinsey report in the 1940s indicates 50% of people probably have animal sexual contact.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so it's this terribly fearsome thing that people might lose their humanity. And I have to say, I was hugely entertained with some of the laws. For example, if someone has sex with a cow, you kill the person, but you can't eat the cow because
mm-hmm.
the cow's been...
Right.
You know, so it's like, it's that concern of losing your humanity in animal sex. And interestingly, I mean, this is perhaps one of our last taboos in sexual discussions about, this is illegal somehow. Unsavory, by the way, I think so, but
mm-hmm.
I'm not sure people ought to go to jail for that.
Mm-hmm.
Editorial comment aside?
Yeah, no, I see just what you mean. I understand just what you're saying. It is unsavory, but jail, maybe not.
Yeah.
I'm always interested in the scriptural foundations of any of this. Does the Bible say anything, Old or New Testament, about having sex with animals? I know it says something about spilling your seed, and that's not right, but does it talk about having sex with animals?
And when these laws go into effect, It's in Leviticus, of course.
Mm-hmm.
If a person lays with a cow or something, you kill both of them.
Is that right?
So
mm-hmm.
the prohibition, again, comes from that list of Leviticus. But like so much with looking back to biblical precedent for prohibiting things, I mean, suddenly you can eat pigs, which is also prohibited in Leviticus.
Yeah.
You know, so you're playing fast and loose with it anyway.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, I see. So you mean, do we have any idea whether this sort of thing was common, that is, having sex with animals? Is there any way to judge that?
The numbers of, well, okay, if we take the modern, numbers of references are a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have, you know, Kinsey saying 50% of Americans, mm-hmm. and then in the Stone Age, we have Stone Age drawings on walls mm-hmm. of people having sex with animals. And in Scandinavia, in the almost the early modern period, boys were forbidden to go herd the cattle because they had sex mm-hmm. with animals, you know, because of the risk of having sex with animals. In Montana, there were laws against shepherds wearing tall boots, which facilitate having sex with sheep.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems, you know, so many references, you have to assume
mm-hmm.
that.
Yeah, when I was growing up, again, in the Midwest, there was something, I learned the expression, the stump rope cow. And the stump rope cow was a cow that you had sex with. I don't mean to offend any of our listeners, but yeah,
Or to cast aspersions on the Midwest.
No, not at all. But that there was a name for it, and that's what I'm trying to point out, that in and of itself, I'm not sure it ever happened, but it was on our mind.
Oh, bet that, on it.
Well, I wasn't going to. Yeah. Yeah. Well, okay, sure. But the fact that we had a name for it was, I thought, kind of significant. Now, of course, well, I'm not going to go any further down that road. So then you have some interesting things to say. Now, these are animals that sort of turn you into an animal if you have sex with it. But then we have, and there are also animals that we don't particularly like because they're omnivores, like pigs. We'll eat them, but, you know, again, a pig will eat you. I don't know if all of our listeners know that, but a pig will definitely eat you. Your cats will also eat you.
Yeah,
your cats will eat you. We know that. We have that on good evidence. There are lots of tests that have been done. People have died in their houses, and your dog will not eat you, but your cat will. I think your dog will eat you.
Your dog will eat you too. There's plenty of evidence.
Probably, yeah. Your dog will probably eat you too. So in any event,
yeah.
but also we hold up certain animals, as you say, and they did too, as exemplars, as things that we should sort of admire in certain ways. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Animals as human exemplars?
Yes.
You mean? Okay, so I have a chapter then. So after moving through these very practical animals, animals as property, animals as food, animals as sex objects, then there are this huge range of animals as human exemplars. And these are the fable animals. You should be brave as a lion, and you should be clever as a fox, and you should not be greedy as a wolf, and ironically, you should not be tame as a lamb because they're just victims. I mean, mm-hmm. they're all of these animal exemplars. And I think in the modern world, we have those as well. I mean, every Disney character mm-hmm. becomes, you know, and everybody's teddy bear becomes an animal exemplar, a metaphoric animal that then shapes what we think about ourselves. So if you read these fables and these metaphoric animals, then you're supposed to learn something. But the bizarre thing is that, at least in my mind, metaphors are an arrow that cuts both ways. Mm-hmm. If you should be like a lion, then that means then you're like a lion. The mm-hmm. lion is like you.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's through these literary animals, I believe, I argue, and lo, this decade, nobody has argued against it or found some other reason for this change in the way animals are viewed and people are viewed. So it looks like literary animals have changed the way we looked at ourselves and opened the way for seeing ourselves as animals.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I see what you mean. Well, you reduced all of your critics to silence, and that's a good thing.
I know.
Yeah,
I
love that. Never happened to me.
Or I challenge them to try.
Yeah, right, exactly. So there are also a lot of, I mean, a lot of this does come, you know, again, naming practice are interesting. I mean, people are called lion, you know, Lev is lion and that kind of thing. One thing I was interested in, because I studied it a little bit, and that is fanciful animals or fantastic animals. Chimerical animals that are half, well, let's not talk half human, but animals that we know for a fact do not exist today. They had a full kind of catalog of those, didn't they?
Yes, and the thing is, once you decide that an animal can be a metaphor for a human behavior, then it doesn't matter if the animal exists or not. If a unicorn becomes more important as a symbol of a fierce affection for virginity, mm-hmm. it doesn't matter whether unicorns really exist. What's more important is the metaphoric reality. So once you've allowed the blurring of reality in your mind, then the animal doesn't matter anymore, and so that means unreal animals can be as real animals. And I think as an example of that, I'll take a real animal, the beaver. Mm-hmm. And what they believed about the beaver is when a beaver is hunted by a dog pack because people wanted the beaver's testicles as an aphrodisiac.
Mm-hmm.
And so as the dogs are hunting the beaver will stop, bite off his testicles, spit them off for the dogs, and then he gets away.
Mm-hmm.
Now, anybody surely who's hunted beavers must know that that surely can't be the case. And you might ask, well, what about the second dog pack that goes after the same beaver? Mm-hmm. Is there a trick? And the beaver then rolls over, indicating, oh, you know, I've mm-hmm. got no testicles left, mm-hmm. so you can leave me be. So all of that, beaver is a real animal, all of that metaphoric weight had to do with sexuality and beavers and has nothing to do with the real beaver.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be a beaver, it could be a unicorn, it could be anything. What's mm-hmm. more important is the lesson learned.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I see. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. One of the things you mentioned, which kind of surprised me, was the lamb, because there's a suggestion in the New Testament that we should be like lambs, because Christ was like a lamb, meek like
the
a lamb.
The Lamb of God.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. But they didn't think that? They thought lambs were sort of...
It's so... I mean, that's the problem with metaphors, too. I mean, yes, the lamb is privileged. You can be like a lamb of God. By the way, lambs were never inhabited by the devil. So you can be certain that the lamb that's on your farm is just a lamb. But at the same time, if you're going to do a metaphor, you don't really want to be like a lamb, because then the wolf will eat you and you're just a victim.
Yeah.
So that lambs really weren't privileged in terms of a metaphor. You'd much rather be the lion than the lamb.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I see what you mean. Yeah, well, it's tough. You know, I always tell people, if you know anything about Christianity, it's tough to be a Christian. It's really, it's a good theory,
no, it's
but it's hard.
Tough. Yeah. It's tough to be consistent. That's
yeah,
all.
It's very hard to be a Christian. Then you go on to talk about animals as not just exemplars, but animals as humans. And one of the interesting things is, of course, humans are subject to God's laws and the laws of men. But it seems so were animals. They were put on trial, for example. Maybe you could talk a little about that.
And this is the new chapter, one of the new large pieces of this book, Animals Taught as Humans. And this chapter is in two parts, the pets and animals on trial. And putting animals on trial, again, was one of those bizarre things that happens in by the 12th century. Let me just give you an example. So a pig was found eating a person, blood on the snout, and ordinarily you would think, good, I'll just kill the pig.
Uh-huh.
But they put the pig in jail, paid the jailer, paid a defense attorney, putting the pig on trial to be sure the pig had a full trial, found the pig guilty, hung the pig by its neck until dead, and didn't pay a butcher to hang the pig, actually paid the larger fee for an executioner to hang the pig. So it's a whole sense of putting animals on trial as if animals have agency, as if they're the ones who had the choice
mm-hmm.
as having done this.
Why did they do this? Why? Please tell me. Why did they do this?
I wish I knew. By the way, I have to recommend a movie made by this.
Uh-huh.
It's called The Advocate.
Uh-huh.
It's an old movie, but it was based on all these trials of animals, and so uh-huh. they made a film of it. It's a very interesting kind of foreign film. Uh-huh. Fun.
Because, you know, Aquinas, okay, I remember this from Aquinas, actually. It isn't Aquinas. It's Aquinas quoting, I think, Aristotle or somebody, and he says, well, the difference between humans and animals is humans have reason. Animals don't have reason.
Isn't exactly.
Yeah, but they still put the pig on trial.
They did. And so the only argument I can make, okay, so here are the arguments that other people have suggested trying to explain it. One is trying to make an example of the pig. Well, they didn't bring the pigs to watch.
Yeah, right.
Right? I mean, I don't know. So, or as a kind of to satisfy the community that this mean pig was dead. I mean, an axe would take care of that in my mind as well. So I believe that, or I argue, and I'm willing to be corrected, that it's only in the 12th century that this happens as a way of recognizing that humans and animals, that the lines are blurring.
Mm-hmm.
And that only there can you sort of satisfy the community by treating the pig like human.
That's absolutely fascinating. That one is, you know, as you said at the beginning of the interview, if you want to understand a place, you should look at the anomalies. And
exactly.
That is very strange.
And by the way, in modern, there's a lot of sort of modern environmental issues around this, putting animals on trial. There are, I found articles in legal journals suggesting that modern animals ought to have defense attorneys as well.
Yeah.
And when Christine Todd Whitman was governor of New Jersey, mm-hmm. she pardoned an Akita who mm-hmm. was on death row for having killed a woman.
Huh.
And that's just so far out there, I can hardly get my head around it. It's
yeah.
like, okay, a pardon means it was guilty.
Yeah, that's confused in a lot of different ways by modern standards.
Yeah.
But anyway,
exactly.
Right. I'm not even going to try to understand that. I would be a little bit upset if the governor of Iowa was spending his time pardoning dogs. But anyway, that's neither here nor there.
I have to give you another modern example that makes it spin a little bit. All right, so in Baltimore a month ago, a boy was on trial for having his pit bull kill someone.
Uh-huh.
The jury found the boy guilty. He goes to jail. And then the judge started to sign an order to kill the pit bull.
Yeah.
But the boy's defense attorney said, wait a minute, you found the boy guilty, so that means the pit bull's innocent.
Wow. That's an interesting argument. I hadn't thought of that, but, you know, I mean...
Yeah, I mean, you got a kind of double jeopardy thing happening.
I do, but I mean, I think the more general point is by modern legal standards, a dog can't be guilty or innocent. Because nobody has jurisdiction over it. It's property, right?
If it's property, you could just kill him.
You can kill it,
but the minute
right.
you, right, the minute right. you let it in there that the dog has some...
Yeah, legal standing,
you know,
other than property.
Legal standing,
yeah.
other than property, then the dog goes free if the boy is guilty.
Yeah. Well, this actually brings me to my next question, and it has more to do with animals as humans, and it's one of the things I think I discovered in the course of my life. I'm not sure. At some point in my life, I noticed that people had started to name their animals things like Mark, Matthew, Luke, and John. And every time I see a dog named something like Mark with what we would call a Christian name, I always kind of take a double take, like, huh, they didn't do that when I was a kid. So did people name their animals in the Middle Ages, and did they name them after people in the Bible, or you know?
We don't have. I mean, there's limited information about what animals were named, right? I mean, but the ones we have, it seems to be either more descriptive,
uh-huh.
oh, brownie,
yeah.
blackie,
yeah.
whitey,
right.
or something like oddly plants, daisy.
Yeah.
Right. Oak tree, something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but certainly, I have not run across anything named after biblical figures.
Yeah, no, but this is a kind of, it would be interesting to have some enterprising historian write the story of how we came to start to name our animals after folks in the Bible, because I got to imagine that in the early modern and medieval period, this would have been a big no-no.
Yeah, absolutely would have been a big no-no.
It was such a big no-no, they didn't even have to mention it.
Right, exactly. That it never even came up. Right. I mean, I think it happens, if I may speculate, out of the range of my book, after the 19th century. In the 19th century, when you have animals and humans being alike because we both have feelings, then you've opened the gate to anything.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's right. But then, you know, I mean, naming practices are an interesting metric of all kinds of different things, really all kinds. And this is an interesting index of secularization, I think.
I think so, too.
Yeah, so, I just wanted to ask about that because of the dog's name Mark and things and David. So.
You know we're in trouble when the dog is named Jesus.
Yeah, no, see, that I don't never seen, but I've never seen that one. So then you kind of conclude the book with a chapter about humans as animals, and maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, once you've seen the lines blur between humans and animals, then humans, some humans are more animal-like than others. And this is, you know, I think one of the horrible things about metaphors and about human beings, that once we've decided that some people are more animal-like than others, you treat them worse. And sort of one of my new sections is treating Jews as animals.
Yeah.
And it makes it wide open for being, you know, appalling treatment. Because people, Jews, women, the poor, begin to be treated like animals. Let me give you an example for the poor. Charity for the poor began to be horse bread, which is animal food.
Mm-hmm.
So you can give horse bread to poor humans. And you've already said then, you're like a horse, you're like an animal. I mean, we recoil from the elderly eating cat food. We don't hand it out as,
right.
as charity.
Yeah.
And so once you decide that some humans are more like animals, then it opens the way to treat them worse, which I find, you know, sad, to put it mildly.
Well, you know, and this gets teeth, actually, in the Age of Discovery, when Europeans start to encounter a lot of people that are very different than they are, and theologians debate whether these things that look like people are, in fact, people.
Whether they have souls or not, and
how they should be treated. And again, you know, I mean, there are probably some of our listeners that are familiar with some of these debates, and they particularly happen in the Spanish context when they are taking over Central and South America. What to do with these people and whether they do in fact have souls. And I think they come down by thinking, well, yes, they do have souls and they have to be saved. But nonetheless, the question has been put.
And, by the way, that's when slavery gets big because you can say, oh, well, okay, they're more like animals than we are.
Yeah.
So you can enslave people.
Yeah, right.
Really, once, you know, so on the one hand, I think at the beginning of the Middle Ages when all humans were dignified more than all animals, it wasn't so good for the animals, but it was better for the humans. Once you have this great chain of being, when some of us are more animal-like than others of us, then it paves the way to treat animals better, like pets, but it also paves the way to treat some humans worse, like animals.
No, that's right. That's right. That's a very insightful point, yeah. So I wanted to actually, I told you at the beginning of the interview, or actually in the pre-interview, I was going to ask you about this, and I didn't forget. I want to talk about it because I think it's an important thing for people to understand about historians and historical work. This is the second edition of a book, and it's an unusual second edition because it has new material in it. And I should, again, just tell our listeners that it's actually quite a rare thing for a historian to take a monograph like this one and then revisit it over a decade after it was published and add new material. How did you come to do that?
In large part, it grew out of all the questions I had had. Again, that endless, so what about the pets? Okay, fine. In part, it was because it's been used a lot. The book has been used a lot and continued to be used a lot, that I felt it was time to add the pets and add more of that vision of how animals began to be treated differently. And I also had done a lot more reading on how humans were treated worse, and I wanted to revisit that.
Uh-huh.
And the final thing was that I wanted to remind people that there was a time when we looked at animals differently.
Uh-huh.
I think that's the thing that history does the best, is it focuses how we see things by showing the time when it was different.
Yeah.
And I wanted to accent that as well.
Uh-huh. Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. And that's one of the things that historians are uniquely able to do, is to show us that things aren't always as they are now, that they were in fact quite different at some other period and quite different in a radical sense. Not like they were, you know, different as in what happened last week, but really radically different.
Didn't have a computer, right.
Yeah, really, really radically.
Honestly, one of the things that I love doing history of mentalité, coming back to the Annal school, is one of the things I find endlessly compelling is how our minds work. How we really look at things differently. It's not just that we do things differently.
Uh-huh.
It's that we fundamentally see the world differently. I think that's very cool.
Yeah, no, I absolutely do too. One of the One question I had, and I guess I'm going to start asking this to all the interviewers, because it occurs to me while I'm speaking with you, this is a really fascinating topic. Could you, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but could you recommend a couple of books? I can think of one. There's a book that I read a long, long time ago by, I think, Keith Thomas called Man in the Natural World. Is that what it's called?
That's
about the early modern period, really, I think.
Early modern period. That's just great.
Yeah, that's a great book. And can you recommend a couple of books, just two, three, on this topic that our listeners could sort of read?
Well, of course, my mind's blanking. But one that's sort of odd is Jean Called Schmidt, The Holy Greyhound.
Uh-huh.
And so here is a greyhound that was treated as a saint.
Uh-huh.
And that's, again, a kind of early modern book.
Uh-huh.
I'm blanking. I'm sort of skimming.
You know, there's this Robert Darton essay, or it's a book called The Great Cat Massacre. I don't know if it has. I've not.
Totally. He's another one in the Annals School. And, you know, he took that anomaly of why do you kill cats?
Yeah.
And say, hey, you know, here you go.
Right.
I mean, the problem with this topic is that it's fragmented in the Middle Ages,
uh-huh.
you know? I mean, you could look at bestiaries,
mm-hmm.
Lynn White's bestiary, but then you're just reading the bestiary. You can look at the fable literature. It's just not that easy. So I would recommend to people to get my book and browse the bibliography.
I think that's right. It's funny because a lot of people ask me what to read, and I say, well, take this book and look in the back. There's this guide. It's called the bibliography.
And give a heavy sigh of appreciation of how much reading I did. And then
Yeah, no, that's, there's, you know, don't ask me. Just look in the back of the book. It'll tell you just what to read. Yeah. So anyway, it's been such a pleasure talking with you today. We've taken up a lot of your time, Joyce. And, you know, I want to congratulate you on the second edition of the book. It's really terrific. And I hope that people go out and buy it. It's called The Beast Within, Animals in the Middle Ages. And it's available right now from Routledge. Let me close the interview, if I may, with our traditional final question on New Books in History, and that is, what are you working on now?
Well, I'm happily finishing up a fourth edition of my Western Civ text,
uh-huh.
The West and the World, and then I'm going to turn to a biography of Galla Placidia, the empress
uh-huh.
of the late Roman Empire.
Yeah, so, my face is scrunched up because I admit I don't know who that is. Who is that?
I know. She's very cool. I mean, she was the empress that essentially built Ravenna.
Uh-huh.
And she got hijacked by a barbarian and swept away out of Rome. Very exciting.
Yeah. Are there any literary agents out there? Because I think you'll want to talk to Joyce about this. Because I know that
I think they would.
Well, you know, a book about Cleopatra is at the top of the charts right now. So this sounds more interesting to me.
Galla Placidia be far behind.
Yeah, I'm thinking maybe this could do it. This could be it. This could be that vacation home in Puerto Rico or someplace. I don't know where. Yeah, all right. Anyway, we've been talking to Joyce Salisbury today about her book, The Beast Within, Animals in the Middle Ages. It's a terrific book. Please go out and buy it. Joyce, thank you very much for being on the show.
Thank you, Marshall.
Okay.
I really enjoyed it.
All right, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Joyce Salisbury about her book, The Beast Within, Animals in the Middle Ages. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week.